Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Lousy, terrible, no good jobs. How do you like that? What else today? Water in West Virginia and high tech comes to chocolatiers. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Friday. It's the 10th of January. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. And that, I'm afraid, is where the happy feeling ends, at least for this particular part of the program. The Labor Department did the overall economic mood no favors this morning when it released the December unemployment report, a flat-out miserable December unemployment report. It must be said, just 74,000 people found work last month. And lest you start thinking the accompanying figure, the unemployment rate dropping to 6.7%, was good news, well, let me have Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman introduce you to a little item that economists like to call the labor force participation rate.
The labor force participation rate, that's the percentage of people who have jobs or are looking compared to all the potential working adults in the U.S. The rate's been going down sharply since the recession. The graph looks like one of those black diamond ski slopes. It hit 62.8% last month, the lowest since the late 1970s. That means fewer people working and fewer people who think it's even worth looking for a job.
There's certainly a long-run trend here that is worrisome, how much people view there to be a positive payoff from participating in the labor force.
Linda Barrington at Cornell's Institute for Compensation Studies says some people were expected to drop out, baby boomers retiring, young people staying in school longer. But, says Heidi Shierholz at the Economic Policy Institute, half the dropouts aren't young or old.
There are 3.3 million workers of prime age, age 25 to 54, people who are very unlikely to have gone into early retirement. They're unlikely to be in school. They would be in the labor force, would be working if job opportunities were strong, but they're not.
Linda Barrington says this is one reason middle-class household income is stagnant, more families living on fewer paychecks.
I think in some cases it is a household decision that the wages you can make don't cover daycare costs.
If you were wondering whether some people who've moved out of the workforce moved into the underground economy, making money under the table, well, if they answered the government survey honestly, they'd be counted as working too. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
There is obviously way, way more of today's jobs report to hash through, which we will do for the next 4 minutes of live radio, maybe four and a half, I don't know, with Catherine Rampell from the New York Times and Sudeep Reddy from the Wall Street Journal. Hey, guys.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
So, Catherine, with the caveat that this is only 1 month's worth of data, I'm right in saying it's lousy, right?
Yes. Okay. There were a lot of discouraging data points in this. Just as we kind of thought there was some momentum building, that we had had a bunch of other strong reports on trade and various other things showing that the economy is doing well, this sort of puts a damper on things. You know, it is one data point,
right.
And it's noisy, so you don't want to put too much weight on it. But if you just take it on its face, it's not good.
All right. So, Sudeep, two questions. One, what the heck? And two, are we looking at another spring swoon, which would be the fourth out of five or maybe the third out of four? I don't know.
Yeah, what the heck with the spring swoon starting in the
right.
winter.
Right.
It's usually not a very good sign.
Right.
Well,
that's
we
right.
do know that the weather, there were weather effects
yep.
in this report. We have to be careful not to overstate them, but we can't get too discouraged about a number that looks kind of wacky when you look at 74,000 jobs created. It doesn't fit with the overall picture of what's happening in the economy. When you see other areas picking up, we're going to have economic growth in the second half of the year that's somewhere between 3 and 4%. Some of the best
wow.
growth we've seen
really?
In years.
You think so?
And in the second half of last year, yeah, we'll see the numbers coming
right.
out fairly soon. And if you look back to prior recoveries, that would be the moment you'd see people rushing into the labor
uh-huh.
force. You'd see people coming back in. So this tells us, though, that something is fundamentally broken right now with our labor market. You're not seeing people coming back in. It could be the aftermath of the recession. People just so cautious, companies so cautious. But it might be something deeper than that that we're going to have to come to grips with if we don't see some kind of a turnaround very soon.
Catherine, spitball it for me. What do you think it might be that is broken? Is it just lingering recession after effects?
Certainly, if you look at the history of financial crises and their aftermaths, they have a huge hangover. It's like 12 years, I think, or 13 years has been the case for the period between, you know, when the recovery starts and how much later it takes until the unemployment rate returns to its previous level. So there is some effect of that. You probably might see some continuing drop in labor force participation in if that's specifically what you're asking about in the next couple months, if indeed this expiration of extended unemployment benefits sticks.
Right, right, right. We haven't even thrown that one in there.
Yeah, I mean, you've seen this happen in North Carolina. North Carolina, because of some policy changes it did in the state, it effectively ended these extended, these emergency unemployment benefits earlier than everybody else. Yeah. And you saw its labor force participation rate drop quite a bit. And so you might see the same thing nationwide.
As Mitchell was telling us, is a bad thing. Sudeep, if you had Janet Yellen's next job, which as of the end of the month, she will be the new chairwoman of the Federal Reserve, and you had to decide on the taper, the withdrawal of the continuation of the taper, right? The withdrawal of the Federal Reserve stimulus plan. Are you pulling your hair out? What are you doing?
If you are sitting at the Federal Reserve, you should be pulling your hair out right now because everything that you have in your toolbox is not really working. We've seen in over the course of 2013 roughly the same pace of job growth we saw over the course of 2012, and that's with more than $1 trillion of bond buying, of money printing from the Federal Reserve. It's not clear that you're getting the liftoff in the labor market as a result of what the Fed is doing. You're obviously seeing in the stock market and all sorts of other financial markets, but it's not going in the direction you want it to go. And it raises a perhaps most troubling part of this is that maybe the Fed can't fix our problems. Maybe we're going to have to rely on elected officials to get into dealing with education and skills and all those things. And you know how we all feel about elected officials these days.
Well, we love elected officials, but they're you know, they're not particularly effective.
The U.S. Congress, right, exactly.
That's right. Catherine, very quickly, your gut feeling about, and I know this is total crystal ball, so I won't hold you to it. Do we bounce back next month or is it another lousy month?
I don't think it'll be as bad as this report, just because this report was so shockingly bad. And as Sudeep mentioned, there were probably some weather effects there. I mean, maybe we'll have some major storms this month that screw with the numbers as well.
Yeah.
But it seems unlikely that this is going to be the new trend. But you never know.
Fair enough. Catherine Rampell from The New York Times and Sudeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal. He is down in Washington. She is in New York. Thanks, guys. Have a good weekend.
Thanks, Guy.
Thanks, Guy.
All right, we'll see you. Wall Street today did exactly what you'd expected to do with a lousy jobs report. It went up. Yeah, I know. We'll have the details when we do the number. Remember the budget deal Congress reached last month? Remember the pronouncement saying it would clear the way for something Congress hadn't done in a good long while, actually pass a budget? Well, the deadline for that budget is next Wednesday, and there is nary an agreement in sight. So House leaders said today they will pass what is known as a continuing resolution, a CR in the Washington vernacular, to keep the government running while they figure things out. We're all pretty much accustomed to budgeting by CR by now. But it didn't always used to be this way, as Marketplace's David Gura tells us.
You could say CR madness dates back to 1974.
Today, the Select Committee on Presidential Campaign Activities begins hearings into...
In the wake of Watergate, when the president was at a weak moment...
Don Ritchie is the Senate historian.
The Congress passed the Congressional Budget and Impoundment Act over President Nixon's veto.
That law created the Congressional Budget Committees and a new structure for budgeting.
When they set it up, they thought that it was making the system more efficient and effective.
And while the process has worked from time to time, it created new rivalries between budget committees and appropriations committees, between Congress and the White House. Jim Savage teaches politics at the University of Virginia.
Before it was seen as a stopgap measure, now it's the way in which you govern.
Lawmakers have relied on the continuing resolution more as politics have gotten more polarized.
What has changed is the frequency and the scope of what is covered in those bills.
CRs used to be smaller. Savage says in the 1960s, there wasn't a single continuing resolution that funded appropriations for an entire year.
The formulas for funding were fewer. You had fewer details.
That is not as rare today. The continuing resolution has become emblematic of the way Congress operates, keeping things at status quo. The last time we had a federal budget without a continuing resolution was in 1997. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
In West Virginia today, the capital city of Charleston, to be precise, the news isn't jobs or the economy or anything more complicated than water. The drinking supply there has been contaminated by a chemical leak that has forced 300,000 people to rely solely on bottled water, of which there is necessarily a limited supply. A lot of people are getting their water at the Fast Check supermarket chain, which is owned by Don Tate. We got him at his Charleston store. Mr. Tate, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
First of all, tell me what it's like at the store today. I imagine lines out the door and busy, busy, busy people
well,
looking for water.
Well, lines are only out the door if you have water.
Do you have water?
I had a truckload that we went and picked up earlier today, and we had 480 cases. It took us about 28 minutes to sell the 480
wow.
cases with a limit of 2 cases per customer.
Do you have people doubling back in line for you?
The lines got so heavy and the streets were parked up, traffic was blocked. I don't know that anyone had an opportunity. Although we did have some people say, well, can I take 2 for my mother? Can I take 2 for the lady next door? And you invariably have to say no.
What are your customers saying as they get to the checkout line? Are they scared? Are they angry?
Well,
what's going on?
They are scared because here again they're talking about the contaminant and how no one really knows how toxic it is. The other thing of it is that they don't know when it's going to be over with, you know.
How did you all get word that this contamination had happened and that you had to be careful? Was it on television? Did they send out? What did they do?
Radio and television. Yesterday afternoon at about 5:30, they called wow. press conferences and the governor was there. And now they're saying you cannot take a bath. You cannot wash your clothes. You cannot prepare food. You cannot use the water from the West Virginia Water Company in any way whatsoever because of the contamination.
If you went out the front door of your store there, Mr. Tate, and looked up and down the street, would there be any open businesses?
Yes, the businesses are open. Now, one of the other things that are not open, none of the food places are open. None of the restaurants. Because, first of all, they can't use the water. They can't wash their utensils or any of those kind
yeah,
of things.
So let's think about this for a minute. All the restaurants are closed because they can't make food. You can't use the water at home to make food.
Yes.
And you have to keep some of the bottled water you're buying to drink.
Yes. Now, one of the things that we're suggesting to our customers is take home microwavable foods.
Oh, yeah.
And the other thing along with we talk about microwavable foods, the other item that comes into play that you may not think about are paper plates or plastic plates, cups,
oh, sure,
bowls,
yeah. yep.
all those items, because people are and plastic tableware, because people are buying those because, quote, in theory, you can't wash your dishes.
You can't even wash it and let it sit out to dry because this stuff might be on it.
So that is correct.
So what are you going to do, Mr. Tate? I mean, if this goes through the weekend, what are you going to do?
Well, I need to wash my hair first and foremost.
something
we've never lived through before.
Yeah.
I was telling some people that the last time I remember we didn't have water was back in the early 40s, and I lived in a rural area in West Virginia, and it was a very dry summer, and the outdoor wells that you had, the well went dry.
Wow.
So, but this is, from the early 40s to now, I've never been without water.
Well, I'll tell you what, Mr. Tate, we will, if this keeps going on Monday, we'll call you back, all right?
All right, sir.
Don Tate in Charleston, West Virginia. He owns some Fast Check supermarkets up there. Take care, sir.
Very nice talking to you.
Coming up.
I've seen tablets used by cable guys, by telephone repair people, by sales forces. Increasingly, we'll see doctors using them.
Chocolate makers, too. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is off 7 points today, less than a tenth of 1%, closed at 16,437. The NASDAQ nudged up 18 points, 0.4%, ended things at 4,174. The S&P 500 inched up 4 points, that's about 0.2%, closed at 1,842. For the first working week of 2014, the Dow off 0.2%. The NASDAQ ended up 1%. The S&P 500 closed up 0.6%. The tech sector was the healthiest place to be today. Microsoft tapped up 1.4%. Cisco spooled up about 0.5%. Even BlackBerry, for crying out loud, had a good day. Rang up nearly 0.5% there. Sears tumbled 13% after it warned that its next quarterly report will be poor. Target fizzled more than 1%. Can't imagine why that would have happened. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.85%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Monday. Opening the week is the Humana Challenge, formerly the Bob Hope Classic. It's the nation's largest charity sports event. If you're in Detroit, keep your eyes open. Maybe you'll see a flying car. It's the 26th annual North American International Auto Show. And it's National Clean Up Your Desk Day. Desk workers will get a chance to prepare for the clutter that's sure to pile up in 2014. I'm Denise Guerra.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The basic rule of the Affordable Care Act, most of us know. Most everybody's got to have health insurance or pay a penalty. Some of the exceptions, though, we may not be quite as familiar with. One of them is for members of what are called healthcare sharing ministries. There are already more than 100,000 people enrolled across the country, and counting, that number is. From KERA in Dallas, Lauren Silverman has the story.
Diane Cozart is a believer. She's a devout Christian whose faith plays out in every aspect of her life, including her health care.
It's a lot more than insurance. It's a great peace of mind, and it really feels like ministry, too.
Cozart and her husband signed up for a program called MediShare. Members of this group agree to a strict set of principles: to attend church, abstain from extramarital sex, and avoid alcohol and drug abuse. You violate these rules and you could lose health coverage.
I like it that my insurance dollars are not going to help pay for folks who live alternate lifestyles and maybe they do things that are not healthful. So my premiums stay down.
MediShare members do pay less on average than they might for traditional health insurance. And less is covered. You can pretty much forget about preventative care, the morning after pill, abortions, or drug rehab. Each month, Cozart pays $592 for her husband and two youngest kids. It's like a premium, but that money is simply distributed to other members with medical needs.
When we got our statement this month, it told me the names of the people who were getting my money. And I could write them a little note of encouragement or I'm praying for you.
In 2005, it was Cozart's name on other people's statements. She had breast cancer and a plan that capped out-of-pocket expenses to $1,200 a year.
I calculated that there were about $100,000 worth of surgeries, but once I met the deductible, that was it. And I never paid any more during that year.
Sound too good to be true? Well, MediShare isn't your typical insurance. In fact, it argues it's not insurance at all. So what's the difference?
The biggest difference is that there's no guarantee your medical bills would ever be paid.
Tony Meggs is president of the ministry that runs MediShare. He explains that the 70,000 members just agree to share in each other's medical needs, but there's no guarantee. There's also no reserves.
If we were to build reserves up, that would be pooling money, and that's insurance. We've created a patented process that simply enables you and I to share money between our accounts.
It's worked this way for 20 years, and supporters successfully lobbied Congress for an exemption in the Affordable Care Act so people like Diane Cozart can stay with their faith-based alternative without penalty. That's good news for health-sharing ministries like MediShare.
Since the passage of the Affordable Care Act in 2010, we have seen significant growth.
Membership has nearly doubled, and that worries critics like Kevin Lucia.
Right now, most states don't see healthcare sharing ministries as insurance, and therefore they don't regulate them like insurance.
Lucia is with the Center on Health Insurance Reforms at Georgetown University. He says under the Affordable Care Act, insurance plans are closely monitored and have to cover essential health benefits, things like lab tests, prescription drugs, and mental health services.
These consumer protections, which are integral to the Affordable Care Act, don't apply to healthcare sharing ministries.
But lack of consumer protections and guarantees hasn't stopped thousands of people from signing up. They're turning to fellow believers and putting their health in God's hands. In Dallas, I'm Lauren Silverman for Marketplace.
Jerry Brown, the past and present governor of the state of California, is out with a new budget plan. Black ink instead of red this time, thanks to higher tax revenues. Big capital gains tax revenues in particular. And yes, we are looking at you, Silicon Valley, and thank you. Among the big winners in his plan, some of the schools out here in the Golden State, as Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports.
More than 12% of school kids in the country live in California. And they got $10 billion worth of good news in Governor Jerry Brown's budget proposal. Schools knew they were going to get a bump. State law guarantees schools a percentage of revenue.
Were you surprised by the number at all?
Yes, pleasantly surprised.
That pleasantly surprised man is John Gray, president of School Services of California, a consulting firm that works with school districts.
It's huge. We haven't had a year like this in a long, long time.
He says schools, on average, could get an extra $750 per student to rehire teachers, restart programs, maybe even create new programs. Most of the money, $6 billion, is going to pay back schools for the money the state stiffed them in previous years. David Plank is executive director of Policy Analysis for California Education, a research center. I ask him what $10 billion means to the state schools.
It's a lot in the context of an education system that has suffered genuinely draconian cuts in revenue over the last 5 or 6 years.
California schools are still short, he says, of where they were in 2007. But the budget proposal is a sign of real progress.
3 years ago, perhaps even 2 years ago, California was looked at across the country as a basket case.
An ungovernable mess. This budget, says Plank, the improving picture, is a sign that California and its schools maybe can work. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
A chocolate factory doesn't immediately bring high tech to mind, digital high tech anyway. But as with the rest of the economy, where in more traditional offices PCs are dying and mobile is where it's at, so too in dark, bittersweet, and milk. Marketplace's Queenie Kim reports.
Cho is an artisan chocolate maker, and its factory is in a huge warehouse on Pier 17 in San Francisco's Embarcadero neighborhood. That's where I met Brad Kinzer, Cho's chief chocolate maker.
All right, so where are you taking me now?
Well, we're heading back into the lab.
Cho is a small business. They have about 60 employees, and its lab looks more like a big utility closet. Alongside one wall, there's a line of small metal containers spinning liquid chocolate.
Different chocolates require different temperatures, different time cycles to create the optimal flavor.
And getting that flavor takes constant monitoring, and generally a batch takes about 12 hours. But Kinzer says...
We do tests up to 40 hours here. It's really a 24-hour process, 7 days a week.
Fortunately, he doesn't have to stand there the whole time.
We have an iPad app that allows us to remotely control a lot of what we do here in the lab.
I've seen tablets used by cable guys, by telephone repair people, by sales forces. Increasingly, we'll see doctors using them. We're also seeing education be a big user of tablets.
Rakesh Agrawal is an analyst at Redesign Mobile. He says tablets have decimated PC sales in the consumer market. And now there are signs that the office could be up for grabs, too.
When you look at the confluence of what the tablets are doing and cloud computing, it is almost a perfect marriage.
Jerry Gravonsky is an analyst at Moody's, and he says not too long ago, tablets couldn't run the software that you needed to work. But increasingly, that software is being run in the cloud. And the big money is betting that the trend towards tablets in the workplace will continue. Scott Jacobson is a venture capitalist at Madrona Venture Group.
Every productivity application you can think of, email, documents, spreadsheets, presentations, is being reimagined.
Right now, Apple, with its iPad, is the immediate winner. But with the battle for the office just beginning, analysts say Google's Android and Microsoft can still catch up. In San Francisco, I'm Queenie Kim for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, streaming video is where it's at, right? Getting what you want, where you want it, on the device you want it on. Maybe. The Supreme Court said today it's going to take a case involving a company called Aereo, backed by media mogul Barry Diller. The business model of that company is pretty simple. It takes broadcast television that anybody can get on their antenna and streams it over the internet to people who pay it $8 a month. The big networks, as you might imagine, are none too happy about that, so they sued. Copyright, among other things. A decision in the case, as you hear elsewhere on public radio, is expected by June. All right, we're done. That is Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow off 7 points, about a 10% or so. The NASDAQ nudged up 18 points, 0.4%. The S&P 500 gained 4 points. That is 0.2% there. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace was developed by J.J. Yore. The program is produced by Sitar Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. We'll see you Monday, everybody. Have a good weekend. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.